Lip smacking good.
And hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of my show called Lip Smacking Good. Well, the motto of this show is, if your lips ain't smacking, it is not good. This is a part of our premium episode, and I have found a good guest for you guys. I've been excited about having her on because I have so many questions that I want to ask her. We can kind of pick a brain about some things. Our guest is named Wody, and she does a podcast called Know Your Food. You can find her on knowyourfoodpodcast.com. Wody, why don't you introduce yourself to our fans?
Sure. Thank you so much for having me. I want to say first, this is going to be a really a big treat. And I love to talk about food, and I love food, so this will be fun. And
yes,
just a bit about me. Well, as you said, I have the podcast called Know Your Food with Wody. And we talk about raising, saving, and preparing food for good nutrition and to put aside for good times and bad times. So that's kind of the focus of the podcast. And it kind of comes off my main site and business called Grenalflins, which is an acronym that stands for God's Natural Organic Whole Foods Grown Locally in Season, kind of the food that we embrace because we recognize all the good things that God's made and the good design he had for food. It tastes wonderful, and when you prepare it well and you choose high-quality ingredients, it's very nutritious and healing. So that's a little bit about what I do. And as far as my family, my husband and I and our three children live in Oregon. We've got a small 5.5-acre homestead. Of course, we're always improving it. We're not there yet, but we raise animals and we garden, and we're always learning and enjoying food and just all the blessings God gives us as we work the land and seek to glorify him.
Also, you have a blog and you do online classes. What exactly do you get with your online classes?
Sure, yes, I do. And, you know, you gave the address for my podcast. It actually goes to my main site. So if anyone's listening types in knowyourfoodpodcast.com, you'll go to my main site.
Okay.
And that's kind of the portal for my blog, classes. We do menu plans. In my online classes, we focus on traditional cooking, and there's so much to traditional cooking. Traditional cooking really focuses on ways to prepare foods so they're very nutritious, because some foods you need to prepare specially in order to, you know, get the most minerals and enzymes from them. And an example of this would be like sourdough bread. Everybody loves sourdough bread.
Mm-hmm.
But before we had little packets of yeast, sourdough bread is the way we made bread for, you know, thousands of years. And it's so good for us because that process of sourdough prepares grains for better digestion. So that's one of the things you teach. I also teach cheese making and making your own cultured dairy, like your own yogurt and your own sour cream. There's other traditional things like fermenting, which sounds like really scary, but it's not, because, you know, you might go get a jar of pickles at the store, but before pickles were made the way they're made now, which is in vinegar and a big plant, you just combined vegetables with a salt brine, and there was a natural kind of pickling that took place with naturally present beneficial organisms that would convert, you know, cucumbers into crunchy pickles or shredded cabbage into sauerkraut. And so that's one of the things we teach. We currently have 7 classes in the online class area, and it's a membership thing. It's not where you have to pick or choose. And you can pick or choose. You can do whatever class you want. But when you're a member, you get access to all of them. So we may have some people that are just coming for the kids cooking class, or some people that just want to learn the fermentation, or some people just sourdough. But we've got 7 classes, including dehydrating. And come August, we'll be adding the 8th. And I guess I could share that here. I haven't publicly announced it.
You sure can.
On my site. But the 8th class will be starting soon is cooking around food allergies. So you know, so many people may gluten or dairy or eggs or there's just so many food allergies. So we're going to cover delicious, healthy, wholesome cooking. Then you have to work around those things.
And you've written books, and you have had ebooks too.
Yes. Every class, when we do a class, it's videos and it's print tutorials. And at the end of the class, we take all those print tutorials, you know, there's just dozens of them, and we put them together in an ebook. And that's very convenient for our members, but it's also this standalone product that people can take home who may not want the video component or the online membership. So it's sort of another option for learning. Yes, and I do have a book in print, and it's called The Complete Idiot's Guide to Fermenting Food. And so see, that came out about a little over a year ago. And if anybody's interested in that, you can go to knowyourfoodpodcast.com/fermenting book.
And on your site, I see like your motto is, we can help you get more from real food. What is kind of the meaning of that? I know you kind of explained that a little bit, but how would you, for somebody who likes food, but they're kind of scared, like once you start using certain terms, you kind of scare them off. Like, how would you introduce this to them?
Sure. Well, you know, this is really the key thing that's behind what we do, because there's wonderful ingredients and wonderful foods. And, you know, we recognize some of them. We've talked about one, you know, sourdough, or we've talked about yogurt or sour cream or, you know, just your favorite foods. And I'm not talking about, like, Twinkies or... Foods that we love that tend, you know, they're not processed. They're just real ingredients. You'd recognize the ingredients. Like, you'd recognize apples and cinnamon and lemon juice and whole wheat flour or, you know, whole milk or butter. We recognize all those foods. So you take all those foods, but some foods need special preparation, and that's where this get more from real foods comes in, and that's where traditional methods comes in, is if you know the way to properly prepare them, then you get more from them. You know, you get more flavor and texture oftentimes, but you get more nutrition and more healing. So like an example of this, I brought it up already, is sourdough bread. Sourdough bread, the reason it's so wonderful is because grains have anti-nutrients. And if you just, you know, grind your wheat into flour, you get whole wheat flour and you make a quick muffin or a quick bread, the anti-nutrients actually block mineral absorption when you go to eat it. So eating grains quickly can cause, you know, over a long time, you might end up with allergies or digestive discomfort or bloating or mineral deficiencies. But if instead you take that flour or grain, whole grains, and you do a soaking, you know, like a 7-hour soak in warm water with a little acid, or if you do sourdough, or if you sprout the grain, those are all considered traditional methods that make the grain then very nutritious and digestible. And so that's what I mean by get more. You know, you're getting more from real foods when you learn the, for lack of a better word, you know, the hang up, and you employ traditional methods, then you end up with something that's delicious, but also very nutritious and digestible. Does that make sense?
It does. And how did you get your knowledge of food? And the reason why I'm asking is because it's like when you talk, you're talking at it from a place where you've dealt with food from a while. But for somebody who, like me, is like scared of a lot of things that you're talking about, or think that it might cost a lot of money, or you're going, well, that's too much work. Like, I'm just speaking, I guess, from somebody who, you know, sees people do things and you going, wow, or just afraid going, I don't know if I could even attempt to do it. And, or either, you know, she's saying get more out of food, but my more out of food, by the time I'm finished, you're really getting less out of food because I'm throwing it away because it's terrible.
Oh, you're funny. And I'm laughing with, compassion because, you know, within the last 10 years is where I learned these things.
Okay.
And mostly within, like, the last 6. And, you know, I have thought all the things that you just said. That takes too much time, or that's too overwhelming, or what's wrong with the way I'm doing it, or, you know, you can say a hope, or it's going to be too much money. Here's the thing. The reason I learned it was because we had food allergies in my family.
Okay.
You know, I mentioned it, bloating and digestion. And we had allergies or sensitivities, I guess you'd say. And we were introduced to this idea that maybe it's in the way we prepare the food that's causing the problem.
Okay.
And I learned that from this book called Nourishing Traditions by Sally Fallon. And I read it for the first time. And I said all the things you just said. Oh, I can't do that. That's just too much time. No, I'd rather we just don't eat gluten because I don't want to learn how to prepare it.
Yes, because it's a whole industry now of everything being gluten-free.
Yes, it is. And and the gluten-free industry, I think, this is a total side note, has gone this direction of not very healthy.
Yes, yes. And I've realized that, too. It's like they take something out, but they have to replace something to get you that same taste. It's like, yeah, we took out the gluten, but we increased the salt. We took out the gluten, but we increased the sugar. We took out the gluten, but we increased the fat. And also it's up to the consumers, which is, it could be good and bad, but they leave it up to the consumers to just understand that, yeah, we taken out something, but you still want that taste. And so, I've realized that a lot of stuff that's like, you know, sugar-free, fat-free, and all this stuff, when I turn and look at the labels, which is something I'm kind of getting better at, but when I turn and look up the label and I put the regular mayonnaise beside the fat-free mayonnaise, I see, you know, yeah, you took out the calories, but you increased the fat, you know, or you increased the calories, but you took something else out, and it's one of the things where it's like, I can't win for losing.
Exactly, And see, this is one of those things where you read all these labels and you kind of end up with, who can I trust? And then you realize that homemade mayonnaise is so easy and it's so much healthier. But yes, I know exactly what you mean. It has really gone the wayside of, the labels. They're misleading and it's just hard to sort it out. So, back to my story, you know, I was introduced to this idea of preparing the food differently and maybe my children wouldn't have allergies anymore. But it just seemed so hard and I put it aside. But you know, then we just kept going through these years and got more food allergies and then it was like, well, what do I have to lose? I'm already cooking.
Yeah.
And then I read it again, this book, Nourishing Traditions, I read it again. I was like, no, that's not that hard. It's just instead of making rice now, you know, I combine it with water and lemon juice, you know, the night before, but I'm still spending the same amount of time. And what do I have to lose? What if it works? And
True.
So we tried it. And sure enough, we found out that our children were not allergic to that food, but that they had built up sensitivities because we hadn't been preparing it right. And so, you know, my son could then eat eggs and my daughter could then have gluten and dairy. Well, the reason the dairy is good for us now is because we're eating raw dairy, raw milk, raw whole milk, which has its God-given enzymes and beneficial bacteria that help you digest it. Pasteurization really and homogenization really destroy milk. And it's very hard to digest and can cause all kinds of problems. So anyway, we just learned that it was worth it. And as far as this idea of that's too much to learn, which is what a lot of people say, that's one of the reasons that I got into teaching this online, because so many people need a little bit of hand-holding, or it's overwhelming. And one of the things that we say is as you move through the online classes, is, you know, just take it one week at a time. So, you know, your first lesson might be learning how to soak grains. It's to do that brown rice I was talking about. So instead of cooking it right now, you start it soaking the night before, and then it cooks in half the time. It has a better texture. But you learn how to do that, and now you know how to do that. And you keep doing that, and then you learn the next thing.
Yeah, it's like almost like building blocks. Like you got a foundation, and then you move on and you move on. You also said you have cows and chickens. Do you have any other animals that you raise on your land?
Right. You know, our animals are constantly changing. We don't actually have a cow at the moment. We have in the past had a dairy cow and a beef cow. We have goats and we have dairy goats. We have sheep are new to us. We have chickens. We've had ducks. we're just always looking for, you know, we're paying attention to the land. How many animals can we raise? Because we don't have, you know, hundreds of acres. And, you know, anyway, you just have issues, especially in Oregon with rain and tugging things up. So we got to balance good for the land. We got to think about what we're producing for ourselves. Go ahead.
And that's true. And I have a question. If I say, well, with all the animals have, and this might sound silly, but have you ever thought about charging people to come and petting them and things like that?
Well, I think someday when we're there.
Because I thought about it. I was like,
open up our farm, but
I was like,
right now it's pretty private.
Okay, no problem. I was like, well, then one day she can get the acres. You know, people just come in and just pet on all the animals.
So actually, we'd love that someday. And, of course, we have friends, and they love to see our animals and things. But,
What is raw milk? When you said raw milk, I was looking like raw milk. I'm not really comprehending it. When you mean raw milk, you're talking about milk that comes straight out the udders?
Basically, yes. Raw milk is the term that just says that the milk hasn't been processed, really. It hasn't been pasteurized. And pasteurization is something that happened early in the 19th century. People were moving into cities and bringing their animals with them, and animals were starting to be fed not very good food, and they were put in confined areas. So their health declined, and therefore the milk got contaminated. And the answer to contaminated milk was to boil it, which was pasteurization.
Ah.
But back then we still had whole milk where the cream separated to the top. And actually, I'm not sure why homogenization started, which was to force the cream to stay distributed through the milk. But that, again, is another issue that just harms the milk. So when I'm talking about raw milk, yes, I'm talking about a healthy animal, very healthy, clean, and cleaned well, and, you know, a milking area that's very clean, and the equipment's very clean, and you milk the animal, and you chill it right away. And, you know, the whole process is very clean, and the milk tastes fresh and delicious, and it's not boiled. The boiling kills enzymes and naturally present beneficial organisms. As well, pasteurization harms the protein in the milk, and it does, you know, other things.
How long?
So raw milk, go ahead.
No, go ahead. Raw milk, what? I'm sorry, sweetie.
Raw milk is just basically unprocessed milk, other than, of course, chilling it. You chill it for safety and sanitation.
Oh, no problem. And my question was about that. How long does it last? Does raw milk last?
Oh, my goodness. Actually, you know, if the conditions are very clean, you can have a jar of milk in the fridge for 2 weeks, and it will be totally fresh and sweet. Now, the thing with raw milk is actually one of the benefits of it is that all the naturally present beneficial organisms that, you know, they're good for you. And if you did, keep it longer, it would tend to sour, not spoil. Whereas pasteurized milk doesn't really have any organisms in it, you know, after it's boiled.
Yes.
And definitely not the protective natural ones. So then spoiling organisms can set in. There's no competition. And so that's why you have, you know, lots of pasteurized milk actually spoiling and going rancid and being really putrid.
Yes, and it's just not good.
It's not good.
No, and in addition to that, what's the difference between having eggs at the store and your chicken actually lays eggs? Like, you literally go out and, like, get the eggs. Like, what's the difference between the type of eggs?
Well, there's a lot of different differences there can be. A major one is just the conditions of the chicken. So most commercial eggs, they're just big chicken houses that are just filled with tens of thousands of chickens that can, you know, barely walk around, and it's very, it's a medicated situation. You know, the chickens are given medication to keep them healthy because their conditions are so bad, you know, they would be sick otherwise. And I'm not saying you want the sickness. I'm just saying the conditions create that. So the way they manage it is through medications. The feed for those chickens is quite often based on genetically modified soy. And, you know, we could talk about genetically modified, but I guess that's a whole other issue. I just would say if anybody's interested in that issue, it's a really good movie. So you could go to geneticroulettemovie.com. I think you can watch it online for a couple bucks, and it's mind-blowing. But anyway, so basically you just have those conditions, and chickens are laying eggs in those conditions. Their diet is poor. Instead of scratching around and eating grass and bugs, they have this genetically modified soy diet. They're in poor condition. So the eggs are just not what they could be. And then eggs are often pasteurized, you know.
How can you pasteurize?
They might be dirty.
When you say pasteurized, is that like homogenous? Do they boil it?
Well, no, because then you'd end up with cardboard eggs.
Yeah, that's what I was like, Karen, that doesn't make any sense. I was like, I don't understand.
I'm sorry. It's just more of a, they do it to the shell.
The shell.
If it's laid, and I'm saying something, I don't know the exact answer to how it's done, but, you know, you have that issue with store-bought eggs. The shell is pasteurized. And probably that's a good thing.
Okay.
Because otherwise they would be passing on whatever's in the chicken house.
Now, true.
Chickens are chickens. You know, most homestead chickens, they roam around and there's grass and bugs. And we make an effort to provide a supplementary feed to our chicken that is not genetically modified soy. So they're getting grains and beans and, you know, things to supplement. And so the egg is healthy. The chicken is healthy. And we can take it right from the nest to the kitchen. And did you notice about eggs, if you wash eggs, they lose their protective coating, and then they don't keep. But an unwashed egg, now you can rinse it, but you don't want to use soap. An unwashed home egg can actually keep at room temperature for weeks to months. You don't even need to refrigerate it. It's just
for
naturally
real?
Protective.
Wow.
Yes, isn't that amazing? And I know this for a fact because we do it. Our fridge could not hold all the eggs we're getting right now.
Wow. Yes, because I know you was telling me and my husband that your children were gone. I listened to your last podcast. You were saying you have like 3 dozen eggs that like sitting around. And I do have a question about that. Like, you were saying that you took them and you like pickled them. Like, what was that process to take?
Sure.
Like, you're looking at like 3 dozen eggs going, what do I do with them? I probably would give them away, you know. I start thinking everything would have eggs, omelet, quiche, like any egg product I could think of. But you're like, no, we're not going to do this. We're going to pickle them.
Well, we actually are eating a ton of eggs. And right now I have about 8 dozen eggs sitting on my counter.
Wow.
And I give them some away. My brother visited and I gave him a dozen and I sent him with another dozen to take to my sister because he was going to see her. So anyway, pickling is just, it's an really kind of traditional thing to do. I did hard boil a bunch and we ate them on salads, but I also hard boiled another 3 dozen and you put them in a jar with spices like turmeric and onion and garlic and mustard seeds and hot red pepper flakes, and you can put whatever you want in it.
And when you say jar, you're talking about like the old school jars with like my mama have with like the mason jars.
Yes, a mason jar. You can do a pint, a quart, a half gallon, whatever. And you pack the eggs in there, the hard-boiled peeled eggs in there with whatever spices. And the key to this, to working, is a salt brine. And I dissolve 6 tablespoons of salt. And I'm talking about not your normal table salt, because that's kind of a chemical product. But go and get some sea salt that has some color in it. If it's like got gray flecks or pink flecks, then you know it's not refined. It has minerals and it's a real salt. Anyway, you dissolve 6 tablespoons of that in water, and that makes your brine solution.
And how and much you, water?
Oh, sorry. 6 tablespoons of salt to a half gallon of water.
Okay, no problem.
I'm sorry I didn't say that. And I should also specify about this, the water. It shouldn't be tap water. It should be filtered. You don't want chlorine or fluoride in it.
Oh, what does that do to the, what does that do to the brine?
Well, the process of pickling is actually to encourage naturally present beneficial organisms to grow and produce acids and pickle your food. It's a bacterial process, a good bacterial process. And chlorine and fluoride will kill that process. because they will kill those organisms. Well, then, so you just want.
Mm-hmm. Well, then what type of water did you want to use? Did you bottled water or is there a particular?
Yes, if you have a filter, a water filter, at
okay.
home, like a reverse osmosis, or I think even a Brita removes
most
fluoride.
Of it. Okay.
I mean, a Brita is like your basic, but a really good water filter would be like a Berkey, B-E-R-K-E-Y, or it, you could get spring water, a good brand. I don't know all the spring water brands, or if you have well water that you know doesn't have. But
okay.
You do need a chemical free water that doesn't have fluoride or chlorine, and you make your salt brine, and this is the key to the pickling. You know, it doesn't really matter what spices you put in the jar with the eggs; those are all for flavor. But the salt is the key, and you pour that brine over the eggs, and then you close up your jar really tight. And you give it like about 3 days at room temperature. And what's going to happen is that salt is going to prevent spoiling organisms to come in.
Okay.
But the naturally present organisms, like on the spices and vegetables, they like that saltiness, and they're going to grow, and they're going to pickle your eggs. And it's really wonderful.
what exactly does like pickling? I know you take a cucumber, I'm going to say a cucumber, and you can turn it into a pickle. And I know that might sound silly, but it's one of those things where I always didn't know that. I thought a pickle was a pickle was a pickle. You looked in the jar and you had pickles.
Well, that's interesting because actually pickling cucumbers, I have a friend and he's from Wisconsin and they just do tons of pickling cucumbers and he eats all his cucumbers. It's a variety of cucumber. That's really good for pickling, but he grew up and they called them pickles.
Yep.
And that's what he all, you know, they use pickles to make pickles. But yes, it's a cucumber. And with eggs, it's eggs and then it's pickled eggs. I mean, you sometimes change the name, like shredded cabbage becomes sauerkraut.
Oh, I'm learning something new. Because like I said, sauerkraut. It's like, hey, I want sauerkraut. It just looks white and withered. So I thought it was just sauerkraut.
Yep. It started as cabbage. And that's a really easy thing to make also. Shred your cabbage and do like about half tablespoon to one tablespoon of that sea salt per head of shredded cabbage.
Mm-hmm.
And cabbage varies how dense it is, but if you have a pretty dense, medium-sized cabbage, this is going to work. Anyway, you shred it and you sprinkle the sea salt all over it and you toss it in the bowl and you just let it sit. Put a cheesecloth or something over it so dust doesn't get in and give it like a half hour to an hour. The salt is going to start pulling liquid out of the cabbage. It's probably called osmosis. My husband would know. He's a chemist. And it gets kind of juicy. And then you pack it in a canning jar, a mason jar, and you cover it just like I told you about the eggs. But you pack it down really well so that all those juices from the cabbage are now covering the cabbage.
Mm.
Just like with the eggs, we covered it with the salt brine.
Yes.
Well, when you do this, it makes its own brine, so you don't have to add more.
Cool. And we were talking about the brine. Is that the same brine? I want to, because maybe this is just what my mind's thinking, that people brine turkeys in?
Yes. You brine.
Okay, so it's the same thing. Because I kept saying, when you was talking about the brine, I said, I hope this is the same thing with turkey, because if not, I'm going to feel like a fool. So let me ask her to be sure, but nothing special.
Yes, it is. Now, brines have different salt concentrations depending on their purpose.
Okay.
So like for most vegetable pickling, I do 6 tablespoons of salt to a half gallon water. And I think brines for turkeys are even saltier, you know, when you do a chicken or a turkey. I think it's even saltier, but I don't know that for sure. So anyway, about the sauerkraut, then you cover that and you let it, you know, it's called ferment. You let it ferment at room temperature for 5 to 7 days, and then you put it in the fridge. Same thing with the pickled eggs. When they're done, you put them in the fridge. They need to be in cold storage to stabilize. Otherwise, they will just get, they'll ferment until they're mush. You want to stop that when it's ripe.
so you do that to actually stop the process.
Yes, you stop the process of fermentation. Fermentation is like this long process and, you know, it's going to go all the way to the point where the food is just totally broken down, but you want to eat it at its peak until it's crisp and, but fermented to the point where it's you know, like the sauerkraut, you know, that's in it, but it's still crisp. You know what I mean?
Yes, it is.
It's not mush. Yeah, that's what you do. So there's tasting involved in this. And if you have a hot room temperature, you know, you might only need 3 days. If it's cold in your house, you might need 10 to 14.
Oh, so you kind of taste it as you go to be sure is the consistency that you desire?
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. It's really, it might sound scary to get into for somebody who's brand new to it. But I think anybody who is halfway intuitive in the kitchen and loves to taste and observe and kind of, you know, fudge a little bit or maybe stray from recipes, this is just like totally for them.
Okay.
Because there's so few rules. And you can, I mean, like the sauerkraut I just told you with the cabbage, you could do cabbage and green onions and carrots and shredded beets and turnips, and you can make a whole kraut mixture out of that because the important thing is the salt.
Yeah.
Encourage the right organisms and deter the spoiling organisms.
That actually sounds really, really good. What is the most unique thing you have ever eaten before?
Oh, that's a good question. Let's see. Well, I have some food from my childhood. I have a Middle Eastern background, and I love all the foods in my childhood except for a couple. The most unique is, oh my goodness, how am I going to answer this question? There is a casserole called, what is it called in Arabic? It's called kifta, but you make this mixture of ground meat and burgal, which is a parboiled wheat, and spice it up. And you press it in the pan, and you can eat it raw. And it's a clean meat because usually, it's like a local pastured meat. It's one you can trust. You know, it's a clean animal. And you can eat it raw, or then you can bake it as meatballs or bake it as a kind of a meatloaf. So I'd say that is one of my most unique dishes. And as a child, I loved it. I just loved it. I have not had it for years.
Wow. Now that's very, very, unique. Like that. That's a good one. Do you go to, like festivals or food festivals where they actually have talk about, the things that you do or like conventions and things like that to get more educated on what you do?
There is a great one. And for anybody who's interested in this, there's a foundation that really works hard to promote traditional foods and traditional arts of farming, and that's called the Weston A. Price Foundation, and it's at westonaprice.org, and it's based on the man who's a dentist. He's passed, and in the 1900s, he traveled the world and studied traditional cultures, and he found that traditional cultures that ate foods with these traditional methods and nutrient-dense foods just were free of disease, virtually free of disease. And he compiled all his findings into a book, and now there's a woman, I mentioned her, the author of Nourishing Traditions, Sally Fallon. She started a foundation in his name, and they have a yearly conference, and it's usually in November. The information is at westonaprice.org, and it's fantastic. I've only gone once. I hope to go again, but they have several days of speakers and food samples and just the latest news, and it's really wonderful. They also have regional conferences, and there's one coming up, I think it's in September, in my area. It's going to be in Portland, Oregon. So they do some regionals, and then they do an annual. And that's pretty much how you stay on top of it.
Because it sounds like you would constantly need to educate yourself, keep on top of it, find out new methods, better methods. Like I said, more cleaner, more safer methods.
Yeah, definitely. They have you become a member, which it's a nonprofit, so it's a really worthy cause. You get a subscription to their quarterly publication, and I usually read it cover to cover. It's got really good information. This last issue that just came about a week ago or maybe 2 weeks, there's a man who is familiar both with both USDA butchering facilities and then small local meat locker facilities. And he talked about the difference between, you know, the two. And it's fascinating. I didn't know anything. And like one of the little things in it was, did you know that the dye that's stamped on meat, you know, when they're, I think it's when they're hanging, is made from blueberries. And there's just a lot of information. And you just learn this every time. I've learned so much from this journal, plus the conference.
Wow.
So I recommend it to anybody who's interested.
That sounds fun. And now at least I know when I eat my meat, I get a little bit of blueberry in it. So thank you for the knowledge.
You're welcome. What? Oh, and I do welcome people to visit my blog. We publish articles 5 to 6 days a week. And you can go to knowyourfoodpodcast.com and then click on blog. And we cover gardening and homesteading and recipes and news and just family stories and farm tours, and there's really good things that we share. Plus, then, of course, in my classes, if you want to take it further, we do more hand-holding and video demonstrations, as I mentioned.
To help people like me who's looking like, ooh, that's a lot. But just talking to you, it really has encouraged me to kind of look at it a little differently, or open up my eyes, or not be as scared. What is your favorite thing to eat that you don't make?
Oh, that's a good question, but I don't make. Okay.
He's going, I'm thinking.
I am. Can it be something that I don't make regularly?
It doesn't matter, anything.
Do you have another question? I can think about that one in the back of my head.
I do. What is your favorite thing to eat that you do make?
Oh, cheese, yogurt. I would say those two. I love those.
She said, I love pickles.
Sauerkraut.
I got that one covered. I can answer that one for you. what is your favorite food that you love that you stash? You go, my husband's not getting this, my kids are not getting this, I'm not sharing.
Oh, it's probably dark chocolate. Which is not probably different from most people, right?
Yes, and dark chocolate is very healthy for you.
Yes, it is.
So hey, I but like this, I like your stash. Your stash is a healthy stash.
That's right. And I thought of something that I don't make very often that I really love, and that's falafel. Have you heard of falafel?
No, ma'am. What is that?
Well, it's a Middle Eastern fried fried dish. You take garbanzo beans and bell peppers and onions and garlic, and you grind them up and make them into these balls, and then you deep fry them.
Ooh.
And my mom makes them, and they are so good. In fact, she won an award in a cooking contest for her recipe. And actually, you can eat them like that, but the traditional way is then to put them into a pita bread sandwich, and then drizzle a sauce called tahini sauce on it. And tahini is a sauce made from ground-up toasted sesame seeds.
Ooh.
And oh my goodness.
That sounds scrumptious.
Sandwich.
I'm listening to you describe that. I go, oh, that sounds so good.
It's very, very good. And I've made falafel once or twice, but it's just a lot of work. So I don't do it that often. I wait and I enjoy it when I visit my mom. She will make it as a treat for us because she knows we love it.
I completely understand that. What is your favorite thing to drink?
It's kombucha. Have you heard of kombucha?
No, ma'am. What is that?
That is a wonderful fermented beverage. And if you have a Whole Foods or other kind of health food store near you, I'm sure you can find kombucha in the coolers with the health food beverages.
Could you spell that?
Yes. It's KOMBUCHA. And there's all kinds of varieties. And it starts out as a sweet tea, and there's a mother culture that you put in it. It's kind of like this this disc-shaped thing, and it's it's a mother culture, and it eats the sugar and gives off beneficial acids, and it produces gases, and it makes it naturally carbonated. And that's how it starts, but then people take it and they do a second fermentation, like with berries or ginger or lemon or something sweet. And so you have all these varieties, like peach or lemon or ginger or berry. And that's what you'll find in the cooler if you go check out one of those health food stores. There's several brands of kombucha and all these flavors, and it's like a natural soda, and there's no downsides to it. I mean, it is so good.
I got to go check that out. It's a health food store. It's kind of like Home Foods or something like that here. And they do like everything is like natural, like very, very natural. And so I got to go. I've never heard of this before, so I definitely got to go check that out. What is the worst thing you've ever ate?
Oh, well, you know, I don't really care for eggplant or okra. There's this dish in my background. Do you love it? Because you're from the South, right?
As weird as that may sound, yes. You know, because, and I think for me, but you see, I got to say, I'm an exception to the rule because I know it's a lot of people down South that don't like okra. And some that don't like eggplant. But I'm an exception to the rule because I am very old school, and I know I've said this before. I am the Mikey. When they, the old school commercials, they're like, Mikey, he eats anything. I'm that child. Yeah. So to me, I love eggplant. Like I like to take eggplant and I grill it, or either I'll chop it real fine. I add it to salads. I add it to my black bean burgers. It's delicious in black bean burgers. And so
you might win me over.
I do like it fried.
Yeah. Battered and fried.
Yes. And what I do with it, with eggplants, because eggplant, it does have like a distinct taste to it. So, and it can be more on the toughier side. For me, whenever I chop it, I always like to chop it thin. A lot of people like to chop it like a chunk. If you chop it thin or either dice it as small as you can and kind of sprinkle it across things, you get the taste without the taste, if that makes sense. It's almost like you can trick yourself into eating it.
Cool.
And so that's one way I do my eggplants. And so with okra, I'm just an okra fan. I like to take okra and I like to put it in soups. I like just regular okra. I like stewed okra. I like, but like I said, and I'm just the type of person who just, but I just, if I don't like it, it is like really nasty. You know, like my mom would tell you, I eat anything. One of the few things I do not like egg custard pie. I think that's so disgusting. Do not ask me why. It's something about the texture of it, and I'll be like, no, ma'am.
That's how I feel about this okra dish that I grew up with.
And you know, and a lot of times what I realize too, a lot of times the way something is presented to you makes a difference, because I have learned over time that sometimes the format or the, like you were talking about, how the way it's prepared and all that stuff, I might not like that way it's prepared. So a lot, so I will try to eat things that I might not like the first time in a different format.
Yes.
You know, to kind of expand or be like, well, I don't like it this way, but I like it this way. And we're talking about that, my black bean burger. With that, I do the eggplants, I do jalapenos, I do banana peppers, I do olives, I will do red roasted peppers, I'll do onions and green peppers and bell peppers. I will do, and I, of course I have the black beans, and I'm gonna tell you what else do I do? It's almost like any vegetable I can put my hand on. I will chop broccoli in there. I will chop squash in it. And what I do when I chop it, I actually chop the vegetables really fine. I'm almost like a chippy type thing. You grind it really, really fine. And, once you mash your black beans, you put it across. And so when I make my black bean burgers, I also add cornmeal to it. I'll add flour to it. I actually add panko breadcrumbs. Am I pronouncing that right? Panko breadcrumbs to it. And I actually will, mix it all together, and I crack one egg and mix it all together. And it's almost like you're looking for a hamburger consistency. So if I get it and it's too wet, I'll add more breadcrumbs. Or if I get it, you know what I'm saying, and it's too dry, I might crack another egg across it. And so once you get it to a hamburger consistency, I make patties out of it and lay them out. And I will either I let it sit for 20 or 30 minutes if I'm going to cook it immediately, or either I'll set it in the refrigerator overnight and wrap it up with parchment paper. So that everything can kind of, I call it gluing together. Mm-hmm. So everything kind of glued together. And what I do, mm-hmm. I put a little bit of oil in the pan and fry it on one side and fry it on the other side. And it's delicious.
It sounds fabulous.
And everything is fresh. You know what I mean? Like everything is fresh as I know I could get it since I don't have a garden. But like, and I know for the things that you grow, it would probably be delicious.
Wow. That is fabulous. It is so loaded too. All those vegetables. I was waiting for you to say, and the ground meat.
No.
But then
no.
You kept listing the vegetables and I knew it was a meatless burger, but it's so full.
And it's one way, I love my husband, one way I can trick him into eating a meatless burger. Like, I know that might sound silly and it's so loaded that you can kind of, and if you want to, a lot of times you can add like, things that are like healthy for people like into it. Like I like to add grains. Sometimes I add grains and oats in there. I'll chop those up too, you know, so I can get your fiber moving. And it's a good way to make a meal especially for a child, especially if they're really, mm-hmm. really picky, because you got the black bean, which, you know, most people, you know, like it. You can spice your black beans up however you want to prepare your black beans. And then once you toss those vegetables in there and you make it a burger consistency, you can, like I said, you can trick a child into eating good.
Wow. That's amazing. That's great. And I'm going to remember that and try it.
And like I say, chop any vegetable, put like this, any vegetable, any pepper, like I said, I have broccoli, and put like this. If I can get my hands on it, and I like to make the burger, I like go to the store and like buy up all the vegetables in there and chop up everything. If I hadn't heard of it, I'm gonna add it to it because everything gives it like a different flavor to it. So it's something you kind of can experiment with.
Yeah. And do you mash up the black beans a little bit too?
Yeah, like before I start, I said, I'm kind of old school, so I like to take I finally bought me a hand, I call it a hand pouncer, but you know, like a hand masher, like you mash potatoes with. Finally got one because I like to hand mash this. Don't ask me why. I'm just a hand masher when it comes to this.
Like
I like to hand mash it, and I mash the black beans until they become a paste. Like that's the consistency you're looking for. It and like the black beans will actually, they'll still be black, but they're turning like a blackish gray because you know the insides will start popping out. So you want it to be a consistency of like a paste. And what I do, because like I said, I normally do canned beans, but to reduce the salt of the canned beans, when I buy them, I take them and I rinse water across it for mm-hmm. several minutes and shake it to get all the extra salt and minerals and, you know what I mean, things that they, preservatives that they put on it. So I realized that reduces the sodium. So I kind of have found ways without going, like you said, 100% natural to kind of reduce it, to make it as healthy as I can, you know, and mm-hmm. I've kind of modified things as I went along. It is one of the things, but that's what I do. Sweetie, I thank you so much for spending your time with me. Tell the people how to get in touch with you.
Yes. Well, you can just go to knowyourfoodspodcast.com, and that's where you will find me and everything, blog and podcast episodes and link to Facebook and link to my YouTube channel. And thank you so much for having me.
I thank you, sweetie. I thank you for taking the time out to be with me. And I thank you for introducing you to the Black Guy Who Tips family. And y'all, I want you to hit her page up, email her, contact her, you know, let her know that you heard about her through our premium content. And I thank you very much. And I hope you enjoy the rest of your day with your husband and your kids whenever they get back home, because I know they'll keep you busy.
Yes, thank you so much. It's been really fun, and I hope we'll get to visit again soon.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you. You have a good one.